Support for the Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Robert Roberson has been given an execution date, October 17th. The state of Texas says Roberson killed his daughter with shaken baby syndrome, something that many now call junk science. There's now growing evidence also that there was no crime, that Nikki actually died from a high fever from a chronic illness. There are many new facts about the case that have come to light that could prove that Roberson is innocent, but it's unclear if the courts will ever consider this evidence and then that an innocent man will be executed by the state of Texas. To tell us more, we're joined by Gretchen Swin, an attorney for Roberson. And Gretchen, welcome back to The Source.
Thank you so much.
So tell me more about this idea that Robert Roberson did not commit the crime, because this idea that that shaken baby syndrome is junk science. And that was a New Jersey courtroom decided that shaken baby syndrome is junk science, but that seems still to be something that many people have got to get a handle on.
Yes. Well, starting with what makes a crime, for something to be a crime, to have a murder, for instance, you have to have actually proven that a person caused the death of the individual. And in shaken baby cases, the idea is you could prove that the last person with a child who collapsed and ended up with a set of internal head conditions had been abused, based on this hypothesis that was kind of thrown out into the world back in the 70s, but never subjected to any meaningful scientific testing. So there was this idea of a causation theory that you must have shaken an infant initially, it was, and then it, you know, got expanded to be applied to older and older children. And the idea was, oh, the way to explain their death, which seemed mysterious, was a shaken baby concept with, you know, these three internal head conditions. And, you know, to sort of help everyone understand, you know, if you look inside someone's head and see that there is bleeding, you know, outside of the brain, and that the brain has started to swell, and that there's also then bleeding into the backs of the eyes, well, one might logically think there's been a head injury. But this is the whole problem, is that a head injury, usually if it's inflicted, or even if it's accidental, there's going to be an external sign of how that head injury was inflicted. And if it is inflicted with enough force to cause something like internal bleeding, it sure had to be powerful. And, you know, for instance, if you pound someone's head, there should be fractures to the skull. And the idea was, oh, maybe we're not seeing anything because what really happened here was shaking. But fast forward, you know, to the present moment, you mentioned this New Jersey court that has now found this hypothesis to be junk science. What they looked at is all of the intervening scientific study, which has shown, wait a minute, if you shake a human, particularly, you know, let's say a toddler the age of Robert's daughter, who weighed nearly 30 pounds, to impose enough force on a human form to rupture their tissue and cause internal bleeding, they've never been able to generate it. And this is in the field of biomechanical engineering, which are the experts who study how people get injured and come up with things like seatbelts to protect us. So shaking has never produced this kind of internal head injury. What shaking would do, was, aside from distressing a child, certainly, would be to injure their neck first and foremost. Well, Nikki had no injury to her neck. Now, meanwhile, there's also scientific evidence that two different things cause these internal head conditions, not shaking. One of them being accidental short falls. You know, if it just seems so unreal that a child could fall a very short distance and hit their head, and that could prove to be fatal. But regrettably, that is a possibility if the child is sufficiently unwell and if the head hits with sufficient force on certain kinds of surfaces. But that evidence was rejected back at the time when Robert's trial occurred. In fact, one after another, medical experts said no way could a shortfall ever cause this kind of injury. And so they treated his report of his child sick in the night, falling out of bed, as a complete fabrication. No way could that explain her condition. Now, on the other hand, there's all this evidence now that medical conditions, natural disease progression, can cause this internal constellation of head conditions. And that seems so weird. How can a disease lead to bleeding outside of the brain? Well, the fact is that scientists have been able to show that it seems to be linked to oxygen deprivation. If the brain is struggling to take in enough oxygen because of illness, the tiny vessels outside of the brain will start to leak. And if that leakage builds up, it creates pressure on the outside of the brain, causing the brain to swell. So it's this cascade of events that has nothing to do with head injury at all.
So you're explaining how much more we have learned since February 2003, when Robertson was sentenced to death after, you know, being convicted of capital murder. And so you have gone back to the Supreme Court and asked for a new trial so that this new evidence can be presented so we could get a clearer understanding of what happened that night that Nikki died, and the Supreme Court said no. So I don't understand how, if it's in the best interest of us to not execute people who are innocent, then why don't we get a new trial?
Well, that is an excellent question. I think there is a tension in the law with what most people would think of as moral. That in the law, there's a privileging of finality over the truth, especially in criminal matters. The idea is if you've had your shot at a fair trial and a jury of your peers has considered evidence and they've concluded you're guilty, it should be really, really hard to ever second guess that. That's how the legal system is set up. Whether that's good or not is a whole nother issue. But that is, you know, basically how our system operates. And it's fine, let's say, if you're talking about a dispute between neighbors over where their property line is. And it's like, you can't get at the truth. Let's get some people in the courtroom, let them hear both sides, and they decide, work out that dispute, move on. That makes great sense. But when it comes to something like a human life, you know, whether it's imprisonment for life or it's the death penalty, it seems like we should demand much more of our judicial system and that the truth should prevail. But we've been fighting this now. It wasn't just the Supreme Court slamming the door on engaging with this case. This fight has been going on since 2016, relying on a really quite forward-thinking Texas law, which has known in sort of popularly as the junk science writ. And this was enacted a little over 10 years ago by the Texas legislature to give people like Robert a chance to get back into court and show that the science that was put before their jury as gospel has not in fact withstood the test of time. And we relied on this, but you know, a law that exists on the books that is not implemented by the courts doesn't do anybody any good. So we feel like we more than satisfied in demonstrating how this version of shaken baby put before his jury has completely been abandoned. I mean, nobody, even those that still believe that shaking can somehow cause subdural bleeding, which has never been demonstrated. But let's say those folks that still are committed to that, they will admit, because there's so many other things that can cause it, you have to look at a child's whole situation, particularly her medical history. And Nikki was a child who had been chronically ill pretty much her whole life and had been exceedingly ill in the last week of her life. But instead of figuring out precisely what was going on with her, she was given medications that, in fact, made her far worse. And this is part of the truth that we have ferreted out over the past 8 years by, you know, fighting for resources, fighting to obtain pro bono support to solve this very complex medical question of what caused this child's death. And I'm absolutely convinced that it had nothing to do with inflicted violence, certainly by my client, Robert Robertson.
But so the medication that Nikki was given, she had pneumonia and a very high fever. And then the meds that she was given, was it the wrong dose or the wrong type? What was wrong with the meds?
Okay, great question. And first, let me clarify that you're referring to the fact she had pneumonia. That is part of the new evidence that certainly was not before the jury and that has still not been considered by a court.
I mean, it seems pretty critical.
Yeah, but there is no denying the fact that her medical records show she had 104.5 fever 2 days before she collapsed. And she was given 2 days in a row prescriptions for Phenergan. That's the brand name for something called promethazine. Well, it turns out after
right. You know what? We're up against this break. We got to take a 1 minute break. We'll come right back. We'll continue learning more about the medication issues that may have led to Nikki's death and why Robert Robertson should be given a new trial, should look at new evidence, try to prevent Texas from executing an innocent man. The source continues right after this.
Support for TPR comes from Jingu House in the Japanese Tea Garden, featuring Asian cuisine with a San Antonio twist. Open for lunch 7 days a week. View the menu at jinguhousesatx.com.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With me on the line, Gretchen Swin, an attorney for death row inmate Robert Robertson. He has been given an execution date by the state of Texas for October 17th. He's accused. He was convicted of the shaken baby death of his 2-year-old daughter. However, there's a growing amount of scientific evidence that shows that the shaken baby syndrome is junk science and that she may have died from a pneumonia, chronic illness that she had her entire life, and also a very high fever. And in addition to that, wrong medication, but by the U.S. Supreme Court says no new trial is needed for Robertson, that this evidence will not be heard, and so Texas is trying to execute him for that. You can call in with your questions and comments, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. So, Gretchen, if you could tell me briefly about the issues of the medication.
Yes, and let me clarify one thing procedurally first. The Supreme Court of the United States didn't say he doesn't deserve a new trial. They didn't engage at all, which is their prerogative. And a lot of people have trouble understanding that. They think, there's the Supreme Court, the last chance to finally get it right. They reject the vast majority of cases that are presented to them. They never even hear them. And so Robert was among those many, many cases that just didn't even get looked at. And it may be shocking. People think, the death penalty, those will be the cases that are reviewed. And in fact, this court has taken up very, very few death penalty cases during the last several years.
Well, let me pick up on that thread and then we'll get back to the medication. So many people, the vast majority of people in Texas, think that the death penalty must have gone through. So if someone is executed, then that person has been given every opportunity to demonstrate that they are innocent, that they didn't commit this horrible crime, and that we can rest soundly thinking that the system works and that people who are executed are really deserving, that they actually committed the crime, that there's no doubt about it. Well, you and I, Gretchen, we've worked on cases before, and we know that's not actually the case, mm-hmm. that there are plenty of ways that the executions happen when there's lots of doubt about whether that person actually committed the crime for which they are convicted. So why is it so hard to get the courts, to get district attorneys, appeals to actually consider actual innocence?
I don't know that I can answer that, but I can say that we just recently marked the 200th exoneration of a person from death row in this country. 200. And that's in the modern era. That tells you at least 200 people. And in fact, statistically, it suggested that it's a far greater number. But 200 people who were innocent were convicted and sentenced to death. That alone should give everybody pause and say there is just not, the system is not working as intended. But it's also a great myth to think that everyone who is sentenced to death had due process all the way through. What is, I think, distressing for a lot of us who dig into these cases. And in fact, the reason that I switched from being a civil appellate and trial lawyer to doing this work full time is I was so appalled by the representation people were receiving in the most serious cases. And, you know, the all critical trial level is where it starts. And with Robert, he had an appointed local lawyer who completely conceded the shaken baby hypothesis of the state. On one hand, you could say, well, all these people in the medical community were telling telling the public this was a legitimate thing. So we give him that. But there was not even an attempt to bring in other experts' perspective. Not a single expert was presented on the defense side. But meanwhile, you have a client who was insisting he didn't do anything to hurt his daughter and that he wasn't going to accept a plea deal. He was innocent and was upset that no one was fighting to figure out what had really happened to his daughter and he wasn't being heard. So that's what goes on at trial. Well, then, as we discussed earlier, after you have this judgment, it becomes harder and harder and harder to convince the court to reexamine the case. And starting with the direct appeal, all you can do is bring claims based on the errors that supposedly were committed at trial, not new evidence. Bringing in new evidence after there's been a conviction is just exceptionally hard, and courts are inclined not to look at it. But in Robert's case, the attorney appointed to represent him in his post-conviction appeals was the same trial lawyer who had conceded it was a shaken baby case. And then his buddy took over for state habeas and never raised ineffective assistance of counsel, never reinvestigated the problems with the causation theory. And that went on all the way to the point where Robert had an execution date in 2016. No one had ever revisited the possibility that he had not killed his child, and in fact, that no one had killed his child. She had died from natural and accidental causes.
So let's get to the, I want to clear the close the loop on the meds. We kind of talked about the medication and the pharmaceuticals that were involved, and they were inappropriate for a child. Is that right?
Yeah, and here's another example. You know, I'm not a medical doctor, and I'm certainly not a medical toxicologist with expertise in medication. So I'm looking at these child's medical records, and I certainly feel like this is a lot of times going to the doctor and the ER and specialist. This seems significant to me. And also, I mean, you know, I noticed she's prescribed this and that. And, you know, one thing that struck me is they kept prescribing different kinds of antibiotics, and that never seemed to cure her infections, which was an indication they probably weren't bacterial infections, but viral. But, you know, I don't know this. It was on the eve of finally getting an evidentiary hearing in this case where we were able to open up the record and present some new evidence that one of our medical experts noticed that this sort of suppressed toxicology report made at the time of autopsy that we hadn't gotten for years and years and years, that it showed she had high levels of several drugs in her system, including promethazine. And he looked it up, like, you know, a curious person would, and found out, okay, that's Phenergan, and then looked in her medical records and saw she had been prescribed Phenergan, and that now Phenergan has a black box warning saying you do not prescribe it to children under the age of 2 or children with respiratory issues because it is associated with suppressing breathing to the point of death. Now, this was a child that Robert brought in to the ER and to the pediatrician several times the week before she died. And one of the complaints was that she was having respiratory issues. She was coughing. She was wheezing. And, you know, one doctor at the ER prescribed Phenergan in suppository form. Then he brings her in the next day because her fever had shot back up. It's measured at 104.5 in the doctor's office. And they send her home with another prescription for Phenergan, this time with codeine. So two doctors, probably not being aware of what the other one has done, give her Phenergan prescriptions 2 days in a row, and then also codeine, which is a narcotic that is absolutely
right. So that seems like that would be enough to even stumble a grown man. Yes. It seems like a lot of medication.
Right.
Well, before we're running out of time here, I just want to try and get to you have a lot to talk about. I'm sorry we don't have more time. We'll try and come back to you. But this is like every parent's nightmare. Something happens to your child. You do everything you can to help them. You take them to the ER, and then your child dies. And now you're going to be accused, you know, arrested, put on trial, convicted, sent to the death chamber, you know, for nothing that you did wrong.
Right. And the other thing that is a common motif in these shaken baby cases, and now they've changed the name. They don't like the shaken baby term. They've changed it to abusive head trauma. But it's the same thing. It's this medical diagnosis of abuse that is ungrounded in science. And whom often gets accused of this? Well, far more often, it's people like Robert who are poor, impaired, have trouble, you know, explaining the complexity of the situation. And, you know, Robert had the added problem that he is disabled. He has rather pronounced autism spectrum disorder. He has a stammer. He has, you know, a flat affect. When he's stressed, he kind of shuts down. So this man who's suffering this incredible shock lost his beloved daughter. He's been bringing her to the doctors and getting the prescriptions, doing what he's told, and then immediately when she collapses, the accusatory eye turns to him. And one of the few positive things I would like to emphasize is that the lead detective who investigated this case as a crime and who testified for the state against Robert, Detective Brian Wharton from the local Palestine police force, has since realized they made a terrible mistake. And he has been speaking out. He is adamant that they got it wrong. They didn't really investigate anything. They didn't know there were any problems with shaken baby. They didn't know about her health issues. They didn't know about his autism. They didn't know about these medications. And all of that should have been considered. And if you look at it in light of contemporary scientific understanding.
Right. So Gretchen, we're running out of time here. We're almost completely out of time. But really, really quickly, do you think public attention to this case, to Robert Robertson, will that have an impact to try to bring this new evidence to light and the courts will take appropriate action?
That is our only hope. I think if the public gets engaged and learns about this case and expresses concern and outrage, there is still some hope. But that's what we're hanging our hat on.
Gretchen Swin is an attorney for Robert Robertson, an inmate on Texas death row. He has a death date set for October 17th. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thank you for listening in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Kayla Padilla is our booking and engagement producer. Engineering support from Ruben Garcia, Jesse Reeves, and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.